Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Everybody loves chickens. And if you leave your doors open, if you don't put them away at night, they're going to get killed. It's just the way it is.
Jana Wilson called chickens the snack food of the animal kingdom. She talks with us today about what you need to do to keep your backyard flock safe from predators. We also hear about the dilemma all small-time chicken farmers have to wrestle with as birds age out of their egg-laying years, to kill or not to kill. It may seem odd that some farmers burn their fields. Harvest Public Media describes why it's actually beneficial. Swiss chard is combined with lots of cheese and eggs in today's recipe. And we'll hear about the marketing push to get some Americans to eat more lamb. Let's get a rundown of the week's food headlines with Lou Ann Johnson.
Tyson Foods announced this week that it would eliminate the use of antibiotics used in humans in its broiler chickens by September 2017. There's a growing concern that antibiotics are being used inappropriately in livestock to make animals larger, not just to treat illness. Some fear the widespread use in livestock is contributing to antibiotic-resistant bacteria found in humans. Tyson's announcement signals a shift in the poultry industry, with more than one-third of the U.S. chicken industry now having taken measures to reduce use of antibiotics. The outbreak of bird flu that has stricken Minnesota turkey farms continues to grow. Now in Iowa, 9.6 million egg-laying hens have been sickened, which equals nearly 20% of the total population of egg-laying hens in the state. Iowa is the top egg-producing state in the country. Wisconsin and Minnesota have both declared states of emergency and authorized the National Guard to help control the spread of the H5N2 virus. H5N2 is a low threat to humans, and researchers are still unsure how the disease is entering poultry facilities. And bees could be getting hooked on pesticides that contain nicotine-like substances, according to a study published in Nature. Scientists at Newcastle University in the UK showed that bees are not able to detect neonicotinoid chemicals in sugar solutions at low levels. And for two of the varieties tested, the bees actually preferred syrup spiked with the pesticides. The study did not test for addictive behavior, but the authors hypothesized that nicotine-like properties could give the creatures a little buzz that heightened rewards in the same way cigarettes do for humans. Neonicotinoids have been banned in Britain for 2 years, but are still widely used in the U.S. Links to read more about these stories have been posted in the latest podcast at eartheats.org.
And Twitter is the place to go to get news updates like these 24/7 at eartheats. Lou Ann, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Annie.
If you've been in farm country this season, you may have noticed billowing clouds of smoke or charred, blackened fields. It's the time of year when many farmers burn their fields to encourage regrowth. For Harvest Public Media, reporter Jacob Grace visited his parents' farm to bring us the sounds of a field on fire.
Okay, let's have a little pre-burn meeting here and make sure everybody's up to speed. The patch of prairie grass that we're going to burn is this 10 acres right here.
That's Jim Grace, our burn boss for today. He's also my dad. He's explaining our strategy for burning the field of dry, waist-high prairie grass behind us.
Anybody got any matches?
Right here.
It might seem strange to be setting a field on fire, but fire is just another tool that farmers can use to improve their land. A burn removes plants that have already appeared, such as weeds, and clears the way for plants that are about to start growing, like grasses and forage for livestock.
Well, we have a northwest wind blowing 10 to 15. Relative humidity currently is 60%.
You need Goldilocks conditions for a burn. Things like wind, humidity, and plant growth all have to be just right. There may only be a few hours out of the whole year that this field is ready to burn. So when the time comes to light the fire, we're holding our breath.
Start over here and see if this is going to burn. Go ahead.
Most of our work got done before any matches were lit. We've already built fire lines around the edge of the field by mowing the grass short and wetting it down. We've also warned the neighbors so we don't get any surprise visits from the fire department. We use a lot less equipment than firefighters do. we're all carrying flappers, which are basically rake handles with mud flaps on the end. They're used to put out small flames. We spread the flames by using a drip torch, which drips a mixture of diesel fuel and gasoline.
So you just, when you tip it down, fuel comes out. Uh-huh. When you raise it up, it stops letting fuel out. So tip it down and let it ignite on a flame there, and then just walk along and drip the fuel out.
The main way we control our flames is by fighting fire with fire. We start by carefully burning up the fuel around the edges of the field. That leaves a blackened, unburnable strip called a fire line. Once our fire lines are finished, we can let the fire inside get pretty big. Good fire lines are important because burns don't always go according to plan.
We're getting a little bit of a wind shift to northeast, which is going to be troubling over here.
As the wind changes directions, the flames that had been small and slow-moving become big, hot, and fast.
It's moist. Should hold it. If we get a wind shift and that thing begins to flame up real big, get out of there.
The flames coming our way are already higher than our heads. As they get closer, we can feel the heat on our faces like a bad sunburn. Clouds of thick smoke are rising up over the farm. But our fire lines are good, and when the fire reaches them, it has nothing left to burn. My mom and I watch from a distance as the flames burn out.
You know, you start this fire like we first started,
uh-huh.
And it's, you know, you think, oh, this isn't so bad, it's under control, and then that kind of thing happens, and it's sort of like, oh boy, you realize the power and the danger, you know?
Barely an hour after we struck our first match, the 10-acre field is blackened and smoking.
Good job, guys.
Well, are we finished?
Yeah, pretty much. Stay and watch it a while.
In a few weeks, the ash will be hidden by vivid green grass shoots, greener and lusher than they ever would have been without a few minutes of fire. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Jacob Grace.
Coming up from Harvest, for every half pound of lamb the average American eats, they cook up to 55 pounds of beef. We'll hear how the American Lamb Board is trying to change that figure. It's a lot of work. It's messy and sometimes smelly, and you need to do a lot of research before you get started. But what you get in return makes it all worthwhile. What am I talking about? Gardening? Composting? It's true of both of those, and it's also true of getting chickens for the first time. A little knowledge before you take the plunge with Jana Wilson, our backyard chicken guru.
Well, I've been called worse.
We love having her in the Earth Eats studios to talk about her adventures raising birds and showing them at poultry competitions. For years, she's raised primarily Sicilian buttercup chickens, a breed that's listed as threatened by the Livestock Conservancy. She expanded her operation this year, and she's now also raising Anconas, which are on the watch list. They're blackbirds covered in white polka dots.
They're kind of like reverse Dalmatians. They're very beautiful birds.
She got them mainly because they're good egg layers. As she's become more experienced with chickens, she's also become more practical.
When I first started out with chickens, I think I was like a lot of people. I'd look in the catalogs. It was like looking at a flower catalog. Ooh, they're pretty. But what I have learned since is that chickens, different types of chickens, have different personalities. They were bred for different things. And I tend to gravitate toward those active and flighty and they, you know, are always curious kind of birds.
So you got these Anconi, you said, because of their egg-laying capacity, one of the many
mm-hmm.
reasons you got them.
Mm-hmm.
Chickens have a lifespan of between 5 and 7 years. They're not going to be laying eggs for that whole time.
No, they're not. You know, their peak egg-laying years are like between 1 and 3 years old, but they don't just stop after 3 years. I've had hens lay up past 8 years old.
Oh, wow.
Now, what happens is after 2 or 3 years, they don't lay as often. When they're in their peak laying years, they'll lay an egg like once every 25 hours. As they get older, it may be just a couple of eggs a week.
Now, look, if you're buying chickens, you order females, but that doesn't mean that you're not going to accidentally get a male chicken.
No, it does not. That's exactly what that means. How this works is the hatcheries hatch thousands and thousands of chicks, you know, on a regular basis. They have people who work at these hatcheries called chicken sexers. And their job is to sit and look at little day-old chicks and determine if they are male or female.
Oh, my.
They're going to miss a few here and there. And it happens more often than you'd think. And, of course, if you live in the city, you can't have a male.
Yeah,
so
it's a problem. What do you do?
Well, there's a number of things. It kind of depends on you and your personal feelings about things. But I know the first thing most people do is they'll go on their Facebook group, or they'll go to Craigslist, or just get the word out that you have a male. And it might be a breed that somebody really wants. You just never know. So that's always an option. If that doesn't work, and unfortunately it does not work a lot, you may have to look for other options. So, you know, you get attached to them, but you have to be realistic and you have to think ahead about what will happen.
At what age will you start noticing that, uh-oh, this is a rooster?
It really depends on the breed. It can be anywhere from, let's say, 4 weeks up to 5 or 6 months. But generally by then, most people know.
They've heard it.
Yeah.
You mentioned that another one of your rules for things to know before you get chickens is learn about their health. Learn what you need to do to keep them healthy.
I've had chickens for 12 or 13 years, and the hard truth is that there are very few vets that know very much about poultry. So what happens is you have to become your own vet. There's a lot of good information out on the internet. There's a lot of bad information. I generally tend to look at websites that have a .edu, a university, agriculture university, generally tend to have the most reliable kind of information. There's also a really good book called The Chicken Health Handbook by a woman named Gail Damerow. I really recommend that for beginners as well, just once again to understand what could happen.
Keeping your birds healthy, you also have to keep them safe.
Yes.
Something people need to know is that chickens need to be shut up at night, mm-hmm, or they will be killed by predators.
Golly, you'd think people would know that, but I have talked to many people who have left their chickens out. They went away for the weekend. They said, well, I just thought we'd leave the chickens out so they could go in and out of the coop. And don't do that. Chickens are the snack food of the animal kingdom.
You've said that before.
I know. Everybody loves chickens. And if you leave your doors open, if you don't put them away at night, they are going to get killed. It's just the way it is. So before you get your chickens, go online and read about how to make coops that are safe, that you can lock up at night. And when you're making your coop or buying your coop, make sure it's healthy for the chickens, too. Healthy meaning it doesn't have leaks, you don't have water inside of it, it has ventilation, all very important.
Jana Wilson comes in to talk to us about raising chickens in your backyard. She has Sicilian Buttercups and Anconas.
Yes, very good.
Your brand new breed. Thanks for being here. Yeah. It's been fun.
Yeah, it's been really a lot of fun. Thanks.
Jana mentioned there what some backyard chicken farmers do if they discover they have a male bird. Also, what about when your chickens stop laying eggs? Later today, we'll speak with some urban chicken farmers about how they deal with this reality. So, now, a recipe that'll help you use up all those eggs your chickens lay.
Gratin is a creamy baked dish. Usually has cheese in it. And a lot of times, if you gratiné, that means that you make something brown and crispy on top, usually with cheese as well.
Parmesan cheese, and a lot of it, comes a bit later in this recipe. Chef Daniel Orr has 8 local eggs on the ingredients list, along with some beautiful Swiss chard.
You know, usually they think, oh, we'll just cook it down like greens. But it's a very different type of vegetable because it has this really colorful, especially the rainbow Swiss chard, has a really, really colorful stems. And it's funny because here in America, a lot of people eat the leaves and they throw away the stems, where in Europe, they eat the stems and throw away the leaves. So it's just, you know, a different continent, different concept.
When he originally wrote this recipe, it only included the stems because he was working in Europe at the time. He changed it so now both the stems and the leaves got tossed in.
So I'm just going to cut the stems into about 1/4-inch pieces. Okay, we're going to rough chop the greens. All right, I'm just going to take these over to some salted boiling water. I'm going to blanch them, cook them till they are a little bit tender, and then shock them under cold water, and then squeeze them out, and then I'll bring them back to the prep table.
All right, next couple steps of this recipe, after this. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Eats here. I'm Annie Corrigan.
All right. We're back at the prep table. Got this beautifully blanched chard. Okay, we're going to start adding our other ingredients. And so we're going to add some bacon. Now, if you're vegetarian, probably want to leave that out.
It's good advice.
Okay, we add some lemon zest. Lemon zest gives you that nice citrusy pop, that wonderful kind of aromatic flavor of the lemon, but without the acidity of the juice. Okay, we're going to add some thyme leaves, fresh thyme leaves. Okay, and then we've got some eggs. Stir that up. Get those eggs all broken in there. The next ingredient is going to be bechamel sauce. Now, bechamel sauce, it's one of what we call in cooking mother sauce. And the way you remember your mother sauce is there are five mother sauces, and you remember TV and bed. So TV, tomato velouté, bed, bechamel espagnol, demi-glaze.
Meaning you just use these all the time?
Yes, they're base sauces, and then lots of sauces are built on top of these. So basically, if you've ever had biscuits and gravy, you've had bechamel sauce. It's a quarter cup of butter, a quarter cup of flour. You cook those down to make a roux, and then you add 3 cups of milk to that, and you cook that for about 10 to 15 minutes, and that's your white sauce. Okay, we're going to add Parmesan cheese. Okay, put this in a nice big baking dish. These are the breadcrumbs that I'm putting on top of the gratin, and then I'm going to top it with a little more cheese, and then we're going to toss that in the oven. It's about 15, 20 minutes, and we've got a wonderful gratin de blette, or Swiss chard gratin.
Beautiful and delicious. Find the recipe at eartheats.org. Most Americans don't eat lamb on a regular basis, but it wasn't always that way. A mix of cultural and economic factors pushed lamb off the dinner table. To put that meat back on the menu, the industry is reaching out to a more diverse set of consumers. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports.
Abdel Himat sits slouched on the bright orange benches of the Centennial Livestock Auction in Fort Collins, Colorado. He comes here every week for the lamb sale.
Sometimes I buy like 300, 400, and sometimes I just go walk away with 80, 90.
A sliding door opens on one side of a dirt pen, and a handful of lambs darts inside. Himat sizes them up, and he flicks his wrist at the auctioneer.
What just happened?
These ones are too big for the ethnic markets.
It was moving too fast for me. But for Himat, it's all second nature. He started at the auction 16 years ago after leaving his home country of Sudan. Back then, he says he was the only Muslim buyer here, taking home about 20 lambs a week. Now he has competitors, and he buys hundreds of lambs at auction.
The younger they get and the smaller they get, the higher they get. The older they get and the bigger they are, the cheaper they are.
He essentially acts as a lamb broker. He buys the young sheep from ranchers here at the auction, arranges for them to be slaughtered and processed to Islamic standards, known as halal, and then drives the meat to about a dozen ethnic and international grocery stores. Some of the lamb Himat buys ends up here, Arash International Market in Aurora, Colorado. Mehran Diba is the owner.
This is the meat department we have. This section from there is going to start all part of lamb. Lamb ribs, lamb shoulders, lamb neck, lamb legs.
Except almost the entire section is empty. A rush on lamb wiped out the case. Diba says at his store, demand sometimes outstrips supply. After Easter, he had to send his buyer on an overnight trip to a Montana auction house to keep his store stocked.
But there's enough of a shortage that he would have to drive to Montana just on a whim.
Yeah, I'm telling you, yes. It's not that easy, you know, Wyoming, Montana, wherever we can find. He goes, you know.
There's often not enough lambs, or at least not enough cheap ones, at auction to fill his meat case at busy times of the year.
And you see, Middle Eastern, Mediterranean people use lamb a lot. You know, lamb is main meat for them.
It's a universal meat. I mean, every religion, everybody eats lamb but Americans.
Megan Wortman is executive director for the American Lamb Board, the promotional arm for the industry. For every half pound of lamb the average American eats, they cook up 55 pounds of beef. That's led to hard times for sheep ranchers. And to keep the industry afloat, Wortman says her goal is to convince the growing American Muslim and Latino communities to eat more lamb.
But we sort of had this assumption that we didn't really need to market to these communities, that they were the ones that already knew about lamb, love lamb, or eating tons of lamb.
But if the industry is going to depend on Muslim and Latino consumers, they're not going to leave it to chance. Wortman says the future of the sheep industry in the U.S. hinges on America becoming a more diverse place. And she says ranchers are starting to understand that. Back at the auction in Fort Collins, rancher A.J. Nelson takes a seat to watch the sale.
My family's been in the sheep industry since 1918 or 19. And my friends and a lot of, extended family, they don't eat lamb.
Nearly all the sheep in Nelson's feedlot end up in processing plants that are halal certified, bound for grocery stores in the Northeast and on the West Coast, where most American Muslims live.
Marketing it towards the Muslim and Mexican communities, that's definitely the way to do it if you're going to want to sell it.
And Nelson says growing those markets is what's going to keep the American sheep industry up and running. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Stories from around America's food and farming scene at harvestpublicmedia.org. What do you do when your chickens get too old to lay eggs? It's not pleasant to think about, but all small-time chicken farmers are confronted with this dilemma. Some farmers let nature do the work, some take matters into their own hands, and others let the birds live out their lives. Sarah Fentum introduces us to some farmers who have to make those tough decisions.
It's a cold afternoon in February, and way out in the country, my boyfriend Elliot is shoveling out his chicken coop.
What is the mess?
Poop.
Ew. Ew, it's in the air.
Yeah.
Gross.
But Elliot's chickens are getting older.
3 years ago, I put this coop together and bought these guys' little chicks. And they've been hanging out here ever since.
How much longer are these chickens going to be productive for you?
I think by fall, I don't think they'll make it another season. Haven't decided what I'm going to do with them yet, but I have butchered them in the past, and that could be their fate.
Elliot's chickens live a traditional country life, literally down a dirt road with no name, and will most likely die a traditional country death. Out here, slaughtering chickens is a way of life. But what about those cosmopolitan chickens? Backyard chickens have become the unofficial mascot of the urban farming movement. As the locavore trend continues to grow, so does the popularity of those backyard hens.
How's it going?
Hey!
Good. Good. Can we help you find something?
City chickens are Ann Collins's specialty.
Because people are so out of touch with their food and where it comes from.
She's the co-owner of Agrarian, an Indianapolis boutique that caters to urban homesteaders.
And I feel like it's a way to gain control back and to learn the old ways of how to actually grow something and cultivate it in your own backyard.
we sold 861 chicks through our store in 2014.
That's Andrew Brake, co-owner of Agrarian with Collins.
So that's a lot of chicks to sell.
Brake is the founder of Naptown Chickens, a chicken advocacy group based in Indianapolis. He raises chickens himself, including a very talkative one I met inside the store. Brake says for urban farmers, chickens are particularly rewarding.
Because vegetable gardening is a very time-consuming, I won't call it difficult, but it's very time-consuming, and you really only get the reward more or less once a year.
And chicken farmers reap the bounty all year round, those beautiful fresh eggs. But unfortunately, nothing lasts forever. Hens can live for up to 10 years, but they only lay eggs for about 5. And then most birds end up on the chopping block. But in the cities, it's more complicated. Even if first-time chicken farmers are comfortable raising chickens, some of them, like Ann Collins, just aren't comfortable killing them.
So my grandmother definitely made stew out of them. I, however, have a totally different view on that, so...
Collins sees her chickens as food providers and pets.
All my chickens have names, and my favorite one's Nina Simone. I could never put her on a chopping block. I just couldn't do it.
For her business partner, Brake, it's a different story.
What's her name and how old is she?
I don't name my birds.
Good idea.
Brake doesn't want to get too attached to his flock. Naming makes that inevitable killing so much harder. Many cities allow urban farmers to slaughter chickens in their backyards, as long as they're quick, humane, and quiet. Brake himself uses a machete. But there are an array of positively medieval-sounding accoutrements de boucherie that fall under the umbrella of humane killing instruments.
It's very, you know, direct. It's called a killing cone.
For the squeamish, many outsource their dirty work to facilities that will slaughter birds for a small fee. There's also the free-range option. Simply leave the door to the coop open and wait for a hawk or an owl to do the work. Collins and Brakes say a lot of people use this method.
A feller said, I just leave the door open at night, hoping that a raccoon, a possum will come in, you know, that circle of life type thing.
Remember my boyfriend Elliot out in the country? He's thinking about trying out this method too. Two of his roosters can't stop fighting, and he's considering turning them loose in the forest to let nature do the work for him. But even if he chooses not to, he still has a lot of options. For WFIU and Earth Eats, I'm Sarah Fenton.
Thanks to Sarah and the other young journalists who have been working with us this year through Indiana University's Media School. Their stories have been archived on our website, where you can also see pictures, eartheats.org. Shoutouts this week go to Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Luann Johnson, Sarah Neil Estes, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thank you for being here today. See ya. I'm Annie Corrigan.